the mood around the Rumsfeld campfire has been all high fives, I told you so's, and endless smug prattling about how the speedy fall of Baghdad is proof positive that those who opposed the invasion of Iraq were dead wrong.
In the past 50 or 60 years after the World War II, almost every single war has had America behind it or some way involved in it.
If you travel around the city of Kabul, you can easily see the signs of reconstruction everywhere. But the main objective, which was peace, is not yet fully accomplished.
All wars are different, and in many ways they're all the same. Wars are becoming more lethal in terms of the weapons used. I think that when the West is involved, they're telling more and more lies.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, April 24th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld is informing the Iraqi people of what kind of government they can now form. Rumsfeld said today Iraqis will be free to form their own government as long as it's not an Iranian-style theocracy. According to the Associated Press, the Secretary of War said, "If you're suggesting how would we feel about an Iranian-type government with a few clerics running everything in the country, the answer is that isn't going to happen." Speaking in his Pentagon conference room, Rumsfeld also said that U.S. and British forces are searching for many more former members of the Saddam Hussein regime than the 55 on a, quote, most wanted list. "In fact, we have a list of some 200, Rumsfeld said. That original list was purposely kept low at the outset because we wanted to separate the worst people from the regime, hoping that others would come forward. Rumsfeld said also, more of the top 55 have been captured in the past day or so than have been made public. He said their identities will be revealed as soon as they are confirmed through interrogation or other means. Rumsfeld, who is scheduled to visit Iraq soon, painted a mostly optimistic picture of progress in stabilizing the country and moving it in the direction of establishing a new government. As evidence of progress, he said, humanitarian aid groups which specialize in emergency care are now leaving Iraq because there is not an emergency in terms of food and water supplies. He would not predict how long U.S. and allied military forces would remain in Iraq. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan called today on the U.S.-led coalition to respect international law as the occupying power in Iraq, drawing immediate ire from U.S. officials. Quote, "I hope the coalition will set an example by making clear that they intend to act strictly within the rules governing occupations," unquote, Annan told the UN Human Rights Commission. The United States responded that it had not been established whether the coalition that toppled Saddam Hussein's regime was an occupying power under international law, but that coalition forces were nevertheless abiding by international conventions. "We've not only made that clear by our words, we've made it clear from day one of this conflict through our actions," U.S. Envoy Kevin Moley told reporters. By a unanimous vote today, the U.N. Security Council approved the extension of the Oil for Food program in Iraq. Speaking in a press conference afterwards, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., John Negroponte, stated that the Secretary General has been authorized to administer the program until June 3rd. Reporters asked whether a situation could be created whereby sanctions will be lifted, but the framework and the structure for the Oil for Food program will remain in effect, ensuring that food can still get to the Iraqi people.
I don't want to speculate about what the architecture might be going forward. This is obviously something that's, first of all, it's quite complex. Secondly, I think it's something that's got to be sorted out internally within our own government and then with coalition allies and then ultimately with the council as a whole. So there's a process here, and I would ask you to bear with us as we work our way through this. It goes back to the issue that we have a completely changed situation in Iraq today. One is going to have to work through all of these, you might call them legacy issues, in time. But the first priority is to stabilize the situation in Iraq. We're in that stabilization phase right now, and that's got the highest priority of our government and our armed forces at this time.
John Negroponte, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Robert Fisk is the Beirut-based correspondent for the London Independent newspaper. He's spent the last three decades covering the Iranian Revolution, the Iranian-Iraq War, the Persian Gulf War, the conflict in Algeria, and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Now that he's exited Iraq, we reached him recently and asked how this most recent war compared with past wars he's covered.
All wars are different, and in many ways they're all the same. Wars are becoming more lethal in terms of the weapons used. I think that when the West is involved, they're telling more and more lies. Arab states routinely lie anyway, but I think we lie more than we used to. And the degree, the number of lies that preceded and coincided with this war was pretty massive. We're still waiting to see a single weapon of mass destruction, aren't we? We're still waiting to see all those people who love us so much for liberating them. I suppose the way it really changed is that for the first time since, 1941, a Western army has occupied an Arab capital. For the first time since 1917, a Western army has occupied the Iraqi capital. The last man to go there was General Sir Stanley Maude, leading a British invasion force almost 100 years ago. And I have actually in my possession his first proclamation to the people of what he called the Vilayah, the governorate of Baghdad. And General Maude, just like General Jay Garner, General Maude said, and I quote, "People of Baghdad, we have come here not as conquerors but as liberators to free you from generations of tyranny." Sounds faintly familiar. And 3 years later, they started to fill up the huge British cemetery on the edge of Baghdad at Northgate with the British military dead because the Iraqis rose in resistance against the British. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dead British soldiers lying there. I was saying to a U.S. Marine not long before I left, if you want to see what might happen to you, you should pay a visit to this cemetery because it happened to us. I thought the Iraqis would turn against their so-called liberators quickly, but not as quickly as they have. That I got wrong. But I think that a long period of occupation government with the resistance of the people in Iraq is about to begin. I think it's one of the great turning points in the Middle East and probably in America's policies in the Middle East, because they can't win an occupation.
We do see on the front page of at least the Washington Post today where the U.S. planners, as they're called, are surprised by the strength of the Iraqi Shiites. And they're quoting the administration that says it's concerned about whether or not this organized Shiite population will rise up, providing an anti-American Islamic fundamentalist government in the country.
Yeah, well, I wrote long before the war that at some point various imams would speak in the mosques and say the Americans must leave. And I said, what are they going to do? Arrest all the imams? Look, having launched an ideological war, which has nothing to do with the facts on the ground, the United States now has a major problem. It is going to have to explain that the people who are supposed to be so grateful for being liberated are in fact opposed to our American and British presence in Iraq. There are various ways this can be done, and we'll see them all in the Washington Post and the New York Times very soon. We will be told that remnants of Saddam's bodyguards, remnants of the Republican Guard, remnants of Saddam's henchmen are trying to destroy our forces in Iraq. Then we'll be told it's Islamic fundamentalism that is the problem. Then we'll blame Iran for it, or Syria, which we already started to do. We'll be told they are terrorists. We'll be told they're Al-Qaeda remnants or remnants of the Taliban. Anything but the one word resistance in Arabic, muqawama. And that is what it will actually be. And it will take quite a time before the Washington Post and the New York Times, who have become faithful spokesmen for the Pentagon and the State Department, to actually tell us the truth. But in the end, they will, because the truth will be too obvious to ignore. And it will be a very brutal war, a very cruel war, one in which both sides will do cruel things. It happened to us, the British, between 1917 and 1920. It's happened to virtually every Western occupier of the Middle East. It happened to Napoleon when he went to Cairo. He also, by the way, issued a statement in the 18th century saying that the people of Cairo should welcome the French because they were the true friends of Islam. You can hear this kind of speech going on all over Iraq at the moment. It's amazing the way in which every time we want to liberate Arabs, we arrive with armies to occupy their countries before we decide to liberate them. I think that in due course, we will have to face the truth that we are not liberators, we are occupiers, and the growing suspicion among the Iraqis that we came for their oil will only be sustained in their minds by the activities of American oil companies and American business in Iraq. The fact But by the time I left Baghdad, I counted 158 government ministries and departments on fire, burning. And the only two that were protected by United States forces was the Ministry of Interior, which of course has the intelligence files, and the Ministry of Oil, of which we need make no further comment, were the only buildings preserved by the U.S. forces. There's a growing feeling in Iraq that the real purpose of this whole, quote, liberation, unquote, is to destroy the infrastructure of government, which has already been done by looters and arsonists, to destroy the culture and history of Iraq. And already we've had looters vandalize the National Museum of Archaeology with its priceless collections of Sumerian history, including the museum in Mosul as well as Baghdad. We've had the National Archives, the Ottoman and Royal Court documents destroyed. We've had the Quranic Library destroyed. In a sense, Iraq is now at year zero, and Iraqis are blaming not Saddam for this, though they all agree he was a cruel and terrible man. Mm-hmm. They are blaming America and Britain as well.
Well, what would the U.S. stand to gain by doing this deliberately? Clearly, the troops stood by
the
city was looted.
They didn't stand by. They just watched. Look, I don't think that individual American soldiers were tasked to watch the destruction of Iraq's infrastructure history. A number of U.S. Marines I spoke to were appalled at what happened. But there's something very odd happened in Baghdad. First, the looters went on the rampage. Now, the fact that they looted the homes of Saddam's henchmen is not surprising. They took from the government departments, the Ministry of Trade, the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Economy, ministries which should have been occupied by a new Iraqi government eventually, all the computers, archives, and files. But after the looters came a separate group of people, the arsonists. They came in blue and white buses. I recognized one who pointed a gun at me the second time I saw him. There were gangs of arsonists who were clearly paid to burn. The fact that they were paid is obvious, because if they're just coming to burn and not to pillage, someone must be paying them. Otherwise, why should they do it? The American version of why this was is that these were men who were paid by Saddam to destroy Baghdad after his overthrow. But I don't believe this for a moment, because if I'm paid, say, $20,000 to set fire to government ministries, and then Saddam goes, I pocket the money and leave. I don't hang around to carry out the work. Why should I?
Mm-hmm.
So these were people who were acting. They were obviously being given targets to burn, map locations. They came in buses. I tried to follow one of the buses. I did for two hours after it left the scene. They did so in front of American troops. I remember watching only a few days ago the Ministry of Higher Education Department of Computer Science on fire and seeing a Marine sitting on a wall next to it. He was a real Marine. I actually called his fiancée for him to pass on his love. A guy called Ted Nyholm, his name was, a third Marines. And he said, we don't know who burned the building next door. I'm guarding a hospital, he said. And yet he was about, 9 meters from a building that was being torched. I said, look, fire, 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 you know. In New York City, you do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, my job is to guard the hospital, sir. And he's a nice guy, by the way. I thought he was a very pleasant guy and very honest. But clearly, no desire on the part of the U.S. military to preserve the archaeology, the history, the documentation, all the government infrastructure in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
After the museum was ransacked, I went to the U.S. Marine Civil Affairs Office at the Palestine Hotel and told them about it. And they said, well, we may get down there. You know, after thousands of years of history have been smashed and looted. Then when I saw the Quranic Library on fire with its irreplaceable collection of illuminated manuscripts, I went to the same civil affairs office and I said, for the love of God, they're burning the Quranic Library.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy said, hold on a minute, picked up a telephone and said, there's a guy here who says they're burning a biblical library. Well, not exactly biblical, but he had the right general idea, religious, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no desire, there was no impetus, there was no foundation, no oomph, as we would say, to do anything about it. One of the Marine officers, whom I became very friendly with, told me that there were all kinds of forces in Baghdad. Some of them would be pro-American, but not necessarily working with the American military. I asked him what he meant, and he didn't really explain. I thought at first maybe, you know, people were being executed or something, but in retrospect, I think what he meant is that there was some kind of impetus to allow the destruction of Baghdad, to put it back to year zero, under the focus of it being revenge attacks on Saddam's regime.
So you're saying that it's your belief that the U.S. troops and the U.S. military was deliberately allowing this to happen, or that some pro-American forces were
I think you're being too conspiratorial. I don't think the 3rd Infantry Division or the U.S. Marines are involved in a plot to destroy Iraq's heritage, no. But clearly, there were agendas being laid down, and people were being paid by somebody to destroy the culture, the architectural heritage, the documented heritage, and indeed the government infrastructure of Baghdad. And these things were going on, and the American military did not intervene. Someone obviously decided there must be orders that U.S. troops do not intervene in looting or burning. Who issued that order? How many people it was issued to? On what authority it was issued? I don't know. But it must have been an order, because a disciplined army, and don't tell me the U.S. Marines aren't disciplined, the U.S. Army did nothing when these acts of vandalism and anarchy were taking place day after day after day. It is not by chance that 3 of the senior members of the administration involved in the heritage of the Middle East have resigned. They should have done. They were right to resign. It was a scandal what I saw there, day after day. And somebody was paying the arsonists. Who it was, I simply don't know.
Now, Robert, you visited the marketplace in the Shu'ale district of Baghdad that was bombed on March 28th, killing 62 Iraqis. The U.S. had denied that it was one of its own missiles that had caused the damage, but you were able to find evidence that proved otherwise. Talk to us about what you found.
Well, to each bombing, each site of alleged bombing that I went to, I searched always for pieces of shrapnel, pieces of metal from the munitions which had caused the explosions which killed people. I've been doing this in Lebanon for a long time. We were able to establish it was an Israeli helicopter that killed the children and women in an ambulance here in 1996 because we tracked the AGM-114C missile fragments back to a Boeing factory in Duluth, Georgia. I was able to prove that NATO, which originally said the Serb Air Force was responsible, had in fact bombed for half an hour a convoy of Albanian refugees, again by fighting computer codes, on bits of the munitions among the dead bodies. Pretty grim task, I can tell you, looking for bits of shrapnel among corpses and people without heads and heads without bodies. In Shu'ale, as in Sha'ab, another marketplace attack, I found pieces of light alloy, which are very familiar to me because they're parts of cruise missiles. In Shu'ale, an old man actually came up to me and brandished a piece of missile part with a coding on, including the date of manufacture, MFR stands for manufacturer, and the lot number. And we were able, the moment I called London, we were able to trace this to a Raytheon factory in the United States, which makes cruise missiles. There were many pieces of shrapnel, which I myself dug out of walls and garbage tips nearby. They couldn't have been placed there so cleverly by the Iraqi secret police, and indeed the people among whom these missiles exploded, certainly one missile, the people there were Shiite Muslims who hated Saddam. The idea that in some way the Secret Service could have come in a few hours and prompted all these people to be perfect actors and persuade me that they brought these pieces of missile came from there when they didn't, which is the British Ministry of Defense version, cannot possibly be true. It is unsustainable. Both in Shu'ale and Sha'ab, these were munitions from the West, and undoubtedly they were fired by aircraft. It's possible that the cruise missile was launched from further away, I don't know. In some cases, in Sha'ab, there was a very thick sandstorm, the heaviest sandstorm Baghdad had experienced in 10 years. People heard aircraft but didn't see them. But I heard an aircraft too about the same time. In Shu'ale, they actually saw the aircraft. So there is no doubt in my mind that these were Western munitions. And we know that a few days later, the Americans deliberately bombed the residential area where they thought Saddam Hussein was hiding in an area called Mansour. They dropped 4 2,000-pound bombs, the so-called infantilely named bunker busters, which they used on Tora Bora in the mountains of Afghanistan in their vain attempt to get Saddam Hussein. Now, you can imagine the effect of these massive armor-piercing bombs in the flimsy housing of civilian areas of Baghdad. They killed 16 people, all civilians. They then said at CENTCOM afterwards, when our forensic teams have gone over the heap of rubble, we'll decide whether we got Saddam or not, but this was not a risk-free venture, i.e. they knew they were going to kill civilians. But in fact, a week after the American occupation of Baghdad, I went to that site, and not a single American or British forensic scientist had been there. In fact, when I was there, they were discovering the putrefying corpse of a little baby, and they put into a black plastic sack. And I promise you that was not Saddam Hussein. So why the Americans or the British should be so upset that they fired a missile into Shu'ala that killed people and claim they didn't, when they openly admit they fired into a civilian residential area at Mansour in an attempt to kill Saddam, an attempt that, of course, failed, mystifies me.
You were also staying, or you were at the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad with other journalists, which was bombed by the U.S. military.
Actually, it was not bombed. It had a tank shell hit it, fired by a tank on the Jumhuriya River Bridge over the Tigris River. Yes. I was between the bridge and the hotel when the tank fired. In fact, the shell went over my head. And I saw the impact of it, a flash and then a cloud of white smoke. And what was rather remarkable is that same morning, an American aircraft had attacked the offices of the Al Jazeera Arab Satellite Channel and killed one of their leading reporters, whom I knew very well because he was standing on the roof when he died, and I'd done several interviews with him on that same roof in the preceding days. So we'd already had what appeared to be a deliberate attack on the Al Jazeera office. Then we had the attack on the Reuters office by the tank on the Jumhuriya Bridge. Now, General Buford Blount of 3rd Infantry Division said later, we were under rocket-propelled grenade and sniper fire. We fired one round, and then the firing stopped. The vicious implication being that in some way the Reuters correspondents, members of an international news team, were either allowing snipers to shoot at the Americans from their hotel room or were doing so themselves, which was a gross libel and a lie. Blount was lying for two reasons, because I was between the tank and the hotel and there was no shooting at all. You couldn't hear a shot fired, so there was no sniper fire at that tank at the time. Indeed, I go further than that and say that if you watch the videotape taken by the 3rd French television channel, you can see the tank with its muzzle pointed towards the hotel room for 4 minutes and there is complete silence before it fired. I've actually managed to get my hands today on a fascinating amount of correspondence between the Al Jazeera channel and the Pentagon. Now, what happened, I was talking today to Mohammed Jassim Al-Ali, managing director of the Al Jazeera channel. Now, this is the channel that was putting out the most heartbreaking pictures across the Arab world and the Muslim world of wounded Iraqis, wounded American and British air raids. Now, on the 24th of February, long before the war began, Al Jazeera, through Mohammed Jassim Al-Ali, sent a letter to Victoria Clark, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., saying, we would like to highlight to you our channel is an Arabic news and current affairs satellite channel with its main offices located in Doha, Qatar, and then pointing out that we have 25 staff members, all civilians, in a medium-sized building in a residential region of Baghdad overlooking the Tigris River. And Mr. Al-Jassim, and I have the letter, I'm holding it in my hands, actually gave the address and the complete satellite collaterals, the actual coordinates on the map of the office. Latitude 3319-2908, longitude 4424-0363, altitude, height of building 63. Now, then he said, should you require any other information, he said to Mr. Clark, please do not hesitate to ask. Your response will be highly appreciated. There was a verbal promise by the Pentagon, and later indeed on the day before the attack on Al Jazeera, from their spokesman, a guy called Nabil Houri, who is a spokesman for the State Department in Qatar, that the office would not be targeted. Then it was. And on that same morning that the Reuters office was hit by the tank, an American aircraft fired a missile into the generator on the roof of the Al Jazeera Bureau and killed Tariq Ayoub, their correspondent and a friend and colleague of mine. Mm-hmm. As a result of this, Al-Jassim sent a letter to Victoria Clark on the 12th of April giving specific details of the attack and reminding her that the Al Jazeera channel had given the Pentagon the exact map locations of the office, asking for an explanation of how this happened. Victoria Clark replied on the 15th of April, 2003, "Thank you for your letter. I offer my sincere condolences to the family and colleagues of Mr. Ayoub." Then going on to say, "Closer to the action means being closer to danger, and knowing that the battlefield will be a dangerous place, we issued repeated warnings to news organizations for many months. Even before we knew there would be military action in Iraq, we warned that Baghdad would be particularly dangerous." Now, the letter in no way tries to explain why the American aircraft attacked the office, how it came to do so, and makes no reference to the fact that it already acknowledged that it had the map coordinates of the office of Al Jazeera. The office, the Victoria Clark final letter of 15th April ends, "War by its very nature is tragic and sad." I would have thought sad is not quite the word to use. "A compassionate country," she's referring to the United States, "has an obligation to wage it as humanely as possible, and that is exactly what we are doing." Needless to say, that doesn't satisfy the Reuters organization, nor does it satisfy Al Jazeera.
Is there an upside to this for the Iraqi people that you can see or that you gleaned from your living there and being there?
Oh, you mean what's good about it? Well, look, everyone was happy that Saddam went, but that didn't mean they wanted the Americans present. And most people, even the poorest, most illiterate people, talk about how, in their eyes, the Americans and the British have come for the oil. And otherwise, they said, why don't they invade North Korea? Well, there isn't any oil, but there's a lot more, there's some real weapons of mass destruction, as opposed to the mythical ones that haven't been found in Iraq. Is there an upside? Well, getting rid of a cruel and ruthless dictator like Saddam, obviously, is a good thing. But since we created him in the first place, I don't think we can pat ourselves on the back. It's we who created him, we who sustained him, we who supported him in his murderous war against Iran between 1980 and 1988. We only started bombing him when he invaded one of our friends, Kuwait, not when he invaded one of our enemies, Iran. So the answer is, for the Iraqis, it's a new ruler. And what is the new ruler coming to do? It was expressed very well to me by a businessman, an Iraqi, who said, look, they won't give a square deal to the Palestinians. Why should the Americans give a square deal to the Iraqis? And I think that Iraqi people, you know, it's a very brutal and cruel place. Very tough people, the Iraqis, but they're very intelligent. I don't just say that because their history goes back 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years. You know, it was always said in the Middle East that they write books in Cairo, they print them in Beirut, and they read them in Iraq. It's a country of artists, a very cultural country, despite Saddam Hussein and the awfulness of the Ba'ath Party and torture and human rights abuses. And these people ask questions. They have very astute political minds. In some cases, a lot more astute than Mr. Pearl or Mr. Jay Garner or indeed Mr. Bush. And I think it will take a lot to convince them that they're entering a happy new age, let alone democracy. They'd quite like a bit of democracy, but I'm not sure they're going to get it.
Robert Fisk, thank you so very much for your time and your unique perspective. Any final thoughts on your part?
Yes, it shouldn't be a unique perspective. There are hundreds of American journalists in Iraq seeing exactly the same as I am seeing, but they are not writing it and they are not challenging the authorities as to why these things are happening. It was that very fine Israeli journalist, Amira Haas, of Haaretz newspaper in Jerusalem. She and I were discussing months ago now what the purpose of journalism was, and I was rabbiting on in my English way that journalism was about writing the first pages of history, and she said, no, you're wrong, Robert. She said, it is about monitoring the centers of power, and this American journalists do not do. The New York Times and the Washington Post have become mouthpieces for power. Fonctionnaires is a lovely French word, civil servants of power. They cozy up to governments. They don't challenge governments, especially in time of war, and they should.
Robert Fisk, the Beirut-based correspondent for the London Independent newspaper. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This program will cease to exist as of May 1st if we're unable to generate enough funding to continue. If every listener contributes $25 or more, that would ensure Peace Watch for another year. We urge you to make a pledge at our secure website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. And mark your donation for Peace Watch. Or send your checks to 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We thank you in advance. We'll be back in a moment.
We took care of Saddam, then watched the mobs rage. We saw medicines and museums looted, and books burned page by page. But we saved the oil ministry with tanks and Humvees. Thank God we know what's important. It's that oil to run our SUVs.